Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We would like to get started on our panel this afternoon. If you are looking for the Writing Religious Biography, you are in the wrong room. This will be Women in Religion. I am Ida Smith and will moderate this panel, and I will introduce each one individually so that you don't forget the details about them before they stand up to speak to you. Our speakers today will be Esther Landa, Penny Ford, Bernice Mooney, and Mary Bradford. Esther Landa will be our first speaker. Let me tell you just a little bit about her. She is a native of Salt Lake City. Her family has been here since the 1880s in Salt Lake Valley. She's an East High graduate, went to Mills College, has received two honorary degrees from the University of Utah and from Mills College. She's past president of B'nai Israel Sisterhood and Salt Lake Council of Jewish Women and the Salt Lake chapter of Hadassah. She's the past national president of the National Council of Jewish Women, active in national Jewish community life, and on behalf of Israel, She's the mother of three children and two grandchildren, and we'd like to present to you Mrs. Esther Landa.
Well, thank you very much, Ida, for that introduction. I don't know if I should apologize for the meagerness of the numbers in the last sentence, but they are the facts. I have three children and two grandchildren. I was asked to talk about women in Judaism, and some of you who had the privilege of hearing Dr. Bennett last night may have gone home as I did and refreshed your memory by looking up Genesis 1 and 2 to try to follow his reference to the place of women. Genesis 1, verse 27, "And God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them." 28, "And God blessed them and said unto them, Be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth and subdue it," etc., etc. Then Genesis 2:18, "And the Lord God said, It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him a helpmeet for him. And the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and he slept. And he took one of his ribs and closed up the place with flesh instead thereof. And the rib which the Lord God had taken from the man made he a woman and brought her unto the man." End quote. As Jewish women, we prefer to believe that the same act of creation applied to both man and woman, making them equal from the very beginning. Both were created in the image of God, both created in the same divine spirit. God's blessing belongs to both men and women equally. In the development of Jewish history, the matriarchs, or mothers of the nation, are accorded the same respect as the patriarchs. For instance, during the Passover service, the chant that the children shout at the end of the service remembers the four matriarchs and others: Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, Miriam, and then Deborah the judge, and then, of course, the one for whom I have the honor of being named, Esther. In the Talmud, there are many references to the merit, piety, steadfastness, and moral caliber of women. The liberation of the children of Israel from bondage in Egypt has been ascribed to the saintly women among them, and on two occasions, the scholars tell us, during the 40 years of wandering, it was women who remained steadfast to their faith and national destiny in the face of popular clamor to make false gods or to turn back to Egypt. Of course, there are uncomplimentary remarks about women as well, but the scholars tell us that on balance, women come out pretty well, more to be praised than censured. The standard text on the role of women is found in the 31st chapter of Proverbs, and I might read that for you. "A woman of valor who can find, for her price is far above rubies, the heart of her husband to safely trust in her, and he hath no lack of gain. She doeth him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeketh wool and flax, and worketh willingly with her hands. She is like the merchant ship. She bringeth her food from afar. She riseth also while it is yet night, and giveth food to her household, and a portion to her maidens. She considereth a field, and buyeth it. With the fruit of her hand she planteth a vineyard. She girdeth her loins with strength, and maketh strong her arms. She perceiveth that her merchandise is good. Her lamp goeth out not by night. She layeth her hands to the distaff, and her hands hold the spindle. She stretcheth out her hand to the poor, yea, she reacheth forth her hands to the needy. She is afraid, not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. She maketh for herself coverlets. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sitteth among the elders of the land. She maketh linen garments and selleth them, and delivereth girdles unto the merchant. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she laugheth at the time to come. She openeth her mouth with wisdom, and the law of kindness is on her tongue. She looketh well to the ways of her household, and eateth not the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praiseth her. Many daughters have done valiantly, but thou excellest them all. Grace is deceitful, and beauty is vain, but a woman that feareth the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hand, and let her works praise her in the gates. Now, a modern-day feminist could read that chapter with a different inflection and come up with something like this, to paraphrase. She does good. She weaves. She works with her hands. She brings food. She gets up early. She buys land. She plants a vineyard. She builds up her body. She stays up all night working. She takes care of the poor and the needy. She eats not the bread of idleness. She makes clothes for her husband and family. She laughs. She is wise and fears the Lord. And all the while she's doing all this, quote, her husband is known in the gates where he sitteth among the elders of the land. Now, in other words, a man, he works from sun to sun, or does he, but a woman's work is never done. Notice, however, and I tried to emphasize it, that in this description, this woman can buy property. She can own property in her own name. She herself is not property. She is not owned. There is nothing in the Jewish marriage ceremony which asks, who gives this woman? Now, this is not to say that Jewish women do not suffer many inequities. Orthodox Judaism is referred to as a patriarchy, and it is very difficult, if not impossible, to change halakhic law. The strictures which Orthodoxy places upon its women have concerned Jewish women throughout the world, and in the International Council of Jewish Women, we have tried to bring these inequities before the chief rabbis in Israel in the hopes that there may be there some latter-day interpretations. The International Council of Jewish Women circulated petitions in every country in which Jews live, and these have been presented to the rabbis in Israel. In 1967, during my first visit to Israel, I remember talking to the wife of the president of the country, enlisting her assistance in persuading the rabbis to remove some of the legal hardships under which Orthodox women live. I don't have time to give too many examples, but one I remember they gave is a law which says that a widow may not remarry until the death of her husband is absolutely proven. So that if an Israeli sailor, this is serious, is lost at sea, and his body is never recovered, she cannot remarry. Now, most Jewish communities throughout the world have made strong efforts to provide girls with a proper Jewish education. In a good Jewish home, the atmosphere of learning and the reverence for traditional learning was bound to have an influence on the girls in that home. Jewish girls were prepared for their place in society, to be wives and mothers, to share in the perpetuation of Jewish values, and to help mold the character of the next generation. In fact, the definition of a Jew comes through the mother. If your mother was Jewish, you are Jewish. If only your father was Jewish, you must receive a Jewish education, be bar or bat mitzvah, and in Orthodoxy, you must go through an Orthodox conversion to become Jewish. Reform Judaism is proposing to change that law to say that if the father of the child is Jewish, then the child is Jewish. This is being put forward by Rabbi Alexander Schindler, who is president of the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, the Reform branch of Judaism. He's pushing this concept, but I doubt that he will have much success with it. I assume that you all know that there are three branches of Judaism, at least: Orthodoxy, Conservative, Reform, or Liberal. And in Israel today, of course, they live under the laws of Orthodoxy. And you may have read after the recent election some of the difficulties that Prime Minister Begin had in forming a coalition government, because he needed the religious party, their members of the Knesset, in his coalition, and in order to get them in, he had to make certain concessions to them toward their orthodoxy. Under Jewish law, women are expected to obey all the thou shalt nots, but they are excused from some of the thou shalls in regard to certain prayers, ceremonies, and customs. If a woman wishes to observe all the thou shalls, she is permitted to do so. But if the press of duties of home and the care of children prevent her from such observances, then that is okay. She is not under obligation to perform these ceremonies, because most of them are time designated and therefore might not be possible for women. The institution of marriage is regarded by Judaism as one of utmost sacredness and of the highest value. And it is a communal responsibility to see that husbands are found for orphan girls, for example. The wife has a highly respected place in the Jewish family, despite the fact that traditional Jewish law places a number of restrictions on the rights of married women. The attitude toward divorce is rather liberal, but until recently, civil divorces were not recognized. But today, if a person wants a religious divorce, they must have a civil divorce first. Moving to more modern times, we find today's Jewish woman is caught in a triple bind. First, we have our traditionally defined role, which I've described briefly. Second, we have the demands of Western culture to become modernized. And in the third place, we have the drive of the feminist movement for equality. For instance, if I do not live up to the traditional concept of the Jewish woman as a good wife and mother, I run the risk of disappointing my parents and, in a sense, of betraying my heritage. But as the Jews emigrated to America in great waves, especially during the latter 19th and early 20th century, the drive for emancipation became stronger. In Europe, the Jewish men were scholars and rabbis, and it was the duty of their wives to support them. As the Jews moved to America, the men had to go to work. Starting in the ghetto, many of them worked their way up, becoming merchants, manufacturers, wholesalers, retailers, and eventually, despite the restrictions of educational quotas, professional men as well, doctors, lawyers, accountants, and so forth. As the men became successful, and some of them became affluent, the role of the wives changed too. The men were too busy making a living to spend their money, and for some, the only way to demonstrate their achievement was to lavish material things on their prized possession, the wife, in their life. Those Jewish women who find themselves in this bind found that any self-realization or actualization was almost impossible. And by the 1960s, thinking Jewish women had had enough of this, and they became among the leaders of the women's liberation movement. And although we are now in the 1980s, we are still struggling for equality in American Jewish communal life. For about the past 5 years now, I have been chairing a task force on women's equality at one of our national organizations called You may stay after class. I've been chairing a task force on women's equality at one of our national organizations called the National Jewish Community Relations Advisory Council. In an effort to push our Jewish establishment into recognizing the contribution of women to community life and to giving us an appropriate place in the decision-making process, we are especially concerned with our professionals, those women who are trained social workers, psychologists, community organizers, etc., and could occupy with distinction any job a man holds, that they be given advancement opportunities and be compensated equally with men. We are making some progress, but it has been an uphill fight. On the volunteer side, we are seeing women being elected to higher positions, for instance, to the presidency of large synagogues and Jewish federations. The West Coast is doing very well in that regard. San Francisco has a woman president of the largest congregation there, Congregation Emmanuel, and in Los Angeles, a woman has headed their Jewish federation. At our next Council of Jewish Federation assembly in November, we will put forward another resolution which the Women's Division worked on at our last quarterly meeting, and it reads like this. In 1975, this General Assembly adopted a resolution calling for non-discrimination in the selection of men and women for the highest Jewish communal responsibilities. It applauded the action of communities where women were participating in the highest policy-making roles and urged all member federations to make the fullest utilization of the talents of all individuals. We now call attention to the continuing need for federations to take action in this area. The Council of Jewish Federations, you have to understand that this is more or less the coordinating body. I can't say governing body because we're not governed, we're autonomous. But anyway, this council reaffirms its commitment to equality and urges all to include more women in communal leadership roles and to upgrade women professional workers in Jewish communal service. CJF commits itself to take additional steps to increase the number of women in leadership roles in CJF. In the general community, women continue to suffer from discriminatory treatment in the workplace and in other areas of life. We call upon our member federations to take all appropriate action to assure equal rights for women. We would have preferred in this statement out-and-out support of the Equal Rights Amendment, but we haven't been able to get that, only this generalized statement. In Reform Judaism, women have been studying for the rabbinate for about a decade or more now, and as a result, we have quite a few women rabbis. The difficulty now is in getting congregations to accept a woman rabbi. Most of the women become assistant rabbis or take a pulpit in a small congregation. Conservative Judaism is still struggling with the problem of ordaining women as rabbis. They are able to enter the Jewish Theological Seminary, but so far I don't think they've been able to be ordained. They keep taking votes at the conservative conventions and in the faculty at the theological seminary, but they haven't solved that. And of course, in Orthodoxy, to my knowledge, there are no women rabbis. Since the word rabbi means teacher, it seems to me there should be no problem at admitting women to the rabbinate, but old traditions die hard. Some of the women in the Reform movement are working to prepare a non-sexist prayer book, and they are making good progress on that. Even here in our own synagogue, which is a merger of a Reform and a Conservative synagogue, as we hear the prayers, you can hear a few women saying God every time the prayer book says He or Father. Women who are qualified to read from Torah scrolls may be called to the Torah, which is a great honor. And if qualified, women can even chant some of the most important prayers during the high holy days. And girls are now routinely bat mitzvah at the age of 13, as are boys becoming bar mitzvah, daughter or son of the covenant. I don't have any statistics on the percentage of Jewish women in the labor force, but I imagine that it's somewhere near the national average. Contrary to popular impression, there are many poor Jews and many Jewish women, especially in the large cities, who must work. Among the younger Jewish women, I imagine that most of them now prepare for careers. Unfortunately, our statistics on divorce, alcoholism, and other social ills used to be exemplary. But as we have become more and more assimilated, our statistics in these areas are similar to those of the general population. So we, too, have many single heads of households. I was amazed in the last session to hear the percentage of single people in the LDS church. But we, too, have many single heads of households. Single parents, both male and female, who are bringing up children alone. This was a problem which the organized Jewish community and the synagogues had overlooked until my organization, the National Council of Jewish Women, brought it to their attention almost 10 years ago. Now synagogues and federations have programs for singles to make sure that the children are not lost to Judaism. On the controversial subject of freedom of choice, which will be discussed in a session tomorrow, I quote from the latest program plan of this National Community Relations Council that I mentioned. Quote, "We recommend that Jewish community relations agencies make known publicly and to members of Congress their advocacy of freedom of choice regarding abortion and their opposition to restrictions of that freedom by denial of public funding of abortions or unreasonable intrusions on the privacy or unreasonable restraints on the freedom of pregnant women to make personal choices as to abortion." Dissent to this policy was expressed by the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations in consideration of Holocaust. They oppose any public policy which would permit or encourage abortion. Hadassah, the Women's Zionist Organization of America, also abstained from the vote, as they said they did not have a consensus on the subject. So that we can see that even within Judaism, there is a great deal of religious pluralism. We share many basic concepts, chief among them, of course, monotheism, and especially ethical monotheism based upon the words of the prophets. I was a little surprised last night when Dr. Bennett, if I recall correctly, said something about fresh discoveries about the teachings of the prophets. But we, in our religion, it is based upon ethical monotheism. But a different Jewish woman might have brought to you a different description of women in Judaism. So let's just say this is Esther Landis' concept and let it go at that.
Our second speaker will be Mary Bradford, who is a member of the Mormon Church. She's a graduate of the University of Utah, a BA, and Brigham Young University, where she received her MA. She's the mother of three children and currently editor of Dialogue, with which I'm sure many of you are familiar, and has also led a seminar for writing for the federal government. Mary Bradford.
Thank you.
One of my friends in Arlington, Virginia, who has become quite well acquainted with a number of Mormon women, quoted me her 11-year-old son's appraisal. "Mormon women all look alike. They have pretty faces and good teeth, and most of them are overweight." I have heard similar statements about Mormon women and Mormon men as well. Just a sea of Mormon faces, so we are. Statements made by those who don't know us and so do not understand us. Jan Shipps, a famous non-Mormon Mormon historian, has tried to understand us. She has spent 20 years studying the Mormons. She says that she has tried out so many models in the attempt that she has finally decided that ours is a unique system. And she refers to the study as a kaleidoscope. I think the image of the kaleidoscope is a very good one for Mormon women. Many colored, shifting when you shake it, changing color as you hold it up to the light, but holding to a pattern, a varied and interesting one. I, too, have been studying Mormon women for the last 20 years or so in a way that leads me to paraphrase Lowell L. Bunyan, who for so many years has symbolized my idea of Mormon theology. One of his teachings is, "The gospel of Jesus Christ is bigger than any one man's perception of it, or one woman's." I believe Mormon women are more diverse, more varied, more complicated, and more wide-ranging in their talents and attitudes than any one woman's conception of them. And I know better than to try to speak for them. So this is just the view of Mary Bradford, for whatever that is worth. At the moment, I am working on a project for Dialogue called the 10th Anniversary Women's Issue. 10 years ago, Dialogue published a women's issue edited by Claudia Bushman and Laurel Ulrich, who went on to found a new Mormon women's newspaper called Exponent 2, and who also edited a landmark book of historical essays called Mormon Sisters. We're trying to look at what has happened to Mormon women in the 10 years since then, and to look at changes and to see if we've made any progress. Of course, we've grown older. Some of us have grown wiser, some of us haven't. We have much interest in life passages and midlife crises. Some of those who worked on that first issue are still looking for role models and mentors, and some of them found them in some of those historical models mentioned in Mormon Sisters. Several women historians are working on definitive biographies of these early women, and there is much desire to learn from these role models. Much work is being done on the concept of Mother in Heaven, including some papers already presented at Sunstone Symposia. Linda Sillitoe put it movingly in an article published in Dialogue early this year, "New Voices, New Songs," about Mormon women as heard through their poetry. Much of it still unpublished. Many of these poets wrote about their search for the mother. "Women everywhere," says Linda, "are seeking for the feminine attributes of God, for a female model of godliness. I believe that these poems demonstrate that for Mormon women, the search is even more urgent than we thought." 10 years ago, that subject was still on the back burner. Today, it is very much with us. 10 years ago, the subject of priesthood and women was a whispered one. Today, people are writing about priesthood and women in ever-increasing numbers, not only about the possibility of it someday being given to women, but the whole subject of priesthood as a concept. There are talking about whether or not it is simply a synonym for the male body, or whether it is dew from heaven distilling and blessing all men and women equally. The theological questions raised by images of Mother in Heaven and the priesthood studies of matriarchal and patriarchal systems also are being considered.
Some students of psychology and mythology believe in certain prehistorical, unrecorded times in which a matriarchal order prevailed. This was supplanted by a patriarchal or technological order of progression and invention of linear thought. Some Mormon women theologians are beginning to think out the possibility of bringing back those two concepts, of combining the matriarchal and patriarchal, the best of both systems. These concepts also impinge upon the political processes of our time. I took over dialogue just after the IWI conference in Utah, and just before the controversies in my state, where Sonia Johnson lives. It ushered in a sour and divisive time for the Mormon sisterhood and raised questions about the women's movement that are not easily answered. I have talked at length with Mormon women on many degrees of that political spectrum. I have interviewed members of the Mormons for ERA and read their correspondence from other Mormon women. I've had extensive interviews with Beverly Campbell. The longest bell I ever heard. Before the trouble started, I met with Barbara Smith in her office. I had a lengthy off-the-record discussion with Bishop Willis. I have sifted through many documents pro and con about the ERA and talked with other women not so well known, but who are worried and in tension and or simply in transition. I'm one of those wishy-washy women who find myself sympathizing with everybody I talk to. I find it difficult to look anybody in the eye and to interview that person about his or her life without feeling moved by their stories, even if I don't agree with their views. I wish that all church leaders on all levels would do more face-to-face interviewing with troubled, perplexed, and yes, even militant Mormon women, to start the healing and the understanding. A couple of months ago, Barbara Smith visited our stake. This was met with a great deal of excitement, and the Stake Relief Society did its usual wonderful job of putting up a arts and crafts festival, refreshments. Some referred to it as the biggest show and tell we've had for years. Sister Smith came early and stood in the reception line so that everyone could meet her. So we looked forward eagerly to her speech. It was introduced by a member of the general board who made a few jokes and comments about Sonia. And then Sister Smith herself led off with a light remark about the Sonia Johnson controversy, and then proceeded to give a speech that had already been published at the Blueprints for Living conference. We were really quite insulted by that, some of us. We thought she, even though she was charming and kind to us, and we enjoyed meeting her, we thought she was missing a wonderful opportunity to come to Sonia's stake, where only one woman had been excommunicated. Only one. But there are many who still support her and who belong to her group, and many others who are still suffering and hurting over what has happened. I think she missed a wonderful opportunity, even if it was just for in one sentence, if she could have stood and said, "Sisters, let the healing begin." In looking over all of this material about ERA and the Sonia Johnson controversies, it seemed to me one word kept coming to mind to describe the whole thing, and that one word seems to me to be unnecessary. It seems to me that Mormon women, for the most part, can be trusted, or could have been trusted, make up their own minds about the ERA. Most of them are not trying to destroy their families or give up their church affiliations. Most of them are not chaining themselves to temple gates. Most of them simply need to think things through and to apply the strong Christian values with which they were raised. Other subjects which we look at when we've looked at in thinking about Dialogue's women's issue had to do also with Mormon women in the arts. And since we are a journal, we think of writing first, and we conducted a personal essay contest called Mormon Women Speak. We will publish about 25 of these essays in a book with Olympus Publishing. This was sponsored by the Silver Foundation, and the winners will appear in our dialogue issue. I added this, I was very much interested in reading these essays. We had about 100 of them. I now have quite a sample, having judged Exponent 2's personal essay a few years back, the personal essay contest. I found at that time that Mormon women were having difficulty finding a personal voice. They were hiding behind male persona and a sermonizing style that we're all familiar with. But I noticed that in our essay contest, more and more women are working toward speaking for themselves and excelling in art forms, which will help us to understand them better. But the whole question of Mormon women in the arts is a difficult one. Meg Monk, who works on Dialogue staff, has written a letter which we're publishing in our next issue. I'd like to quote briefly from that. She's talking about Mormon art, and she said that the main problem with women is the time problem. Members who are attempting serious artistic, musical, or literary work, particularly if they are not professionals who are being paid for their time, need to be given enough freedom from church assignments that they have time to create. It is much easier to look a bishop in the eye and decline a demanding church assignment on grounds of work or family than it is to say, I want to write a play or I want to paint a portrait this year. And then she points out how Susan Roylance, a Washington state politician, when she decided to run for Congress, was told by her bishop that she would be released to do so. It would be nice if bishops were willing to release members to work on certain other important artistic projects beyond the political ones. On the whole, our voices are still struggling to come out from behind the stereotypes, but they are growing clearer. I think the new consolidated meeting schedule has helped somewhat by opening up the week so that people can work more in their communities and do not have to spend so much time in Mormon meetings. However, I've been told that there is a movement to bring the weekday meetings back because many Mormon women feel that they don't know what to do with their time, for one thing. But there's also another important reason, and that is that they are missing the network that they felt they had. There was more of a... It's very hard to get together with your friends on that consolidated meeting schedule. So an important concept is networking, building groups and friendships through these groups. And as Mary Beth Raines has pointed out, these important family friendship networks. One example of this is the Alice Reynolds Club. I see many of them sitting down here in front. Have been meeting for many years in the Provo Orem area. That's a wonderful example of a strong network of strong Mormon women. And I see other networks springing up, some of them loose, some of them quite well organized. And I think it's very important that these continue. Laurel Ulrich has remarked that Mormon women are now earning the right to become superwomen, just as the rest of the world is moving away from that impractical ideal. And it seems to fit in with Melody Minch, Charles' view about the church having come around to the idea that separate but equal is a good position to take when the government's already realized that doesn't work. And it reminds me of the fact that when I was in MIA, as we called it in those days, the jitterbug was banned from church. But by the time my children became teenagers, they were being taught to jitterbug at Mutual. It seems we're always just 20 years behind or so. So it may be that we will catch up on some of these other concepts. We are hoping that our women's issue will highlight artists of various kinds. We're publishing some prize-winning work of Judy McConkie's, and Robin Hammett is working on a photographic essay on Mormon women called In Context. She photographs Mormon women doing some of the things they enjoy most. For instance, there's a picture of a woman nursing her baby and writing in her journal at the same time. There's a picture of a woman who's demonstrating her carpentry skills. She does all the carpentry work in her family, including adding rooms to the house. Another teaches a seminar, another speaks in church, a teenager works on her car. What Robin needs is a grant so that she can travel to other countries and really give us a wider view of Mormon women. My own experience tells me that Mormon women are not all alike, but that they do share common values, a noble heritage, whether a pioneer or a conversion experience, satisfactions with their family lives and friendships, sometimes made difficult because families are difficult. But most of them value their relationships above their own abilities. And I do think that something is very much afoot in the land. I think that there's a sifting and a shifting. There's both a frustration and an excitement. Women are having wider opportunities in which to move and to have their being. I think they are moving forward, especially in applying their theology to their own lives and to trying to search for a Christ-centered life. And I think that if the men don't realize this and get some networks of their own beyond priesthood meeting, we may leave them behind in the study of religion. If you heard Mary Beth Raines or Larry Foster or Melody Charles today, I think you'll have even a better conception of where thinking Mormon women are going. I myself am not discouraged. I feel with that old song of Helen Reddy, I am woman, I am strong, but I will not move any further until my brother understands. I don't think our brothers need to fear us. I think that they need to trust us, and I am willing to help in this great movement forward. Thank you very much.
Our third speaker will be Penny Ford, who is a member of the Episcopalian faith at the St. James Episcopal Church in Salt Lake. She's been active in women in Protestantism. She got her B.A. in history from the University of Utah, her M.A. in education also from the University of Utah. She was delegate to the State Episcopal Convention and co-chair of St. James Venture Mission Fundraising Drive. She is the mother of a three-year-old daughter and is a housewife. Penny Ford.
Good afternoon. In spite of the program, I do not feel qualified to speak for women, Protestantism, or St. James Episcopal Church. I am a woman who has been close to the Episcopal Church at intervals in my life. My belief in God and my spiritual relationships are personal and deeper and more specific than my commitment to any institution. Many times when I have had an insight about what is true for me, it seems to be at odds with some of the church doctrines, and I'm challenged to reconcile, justify, or ignore the church or my insight. I see my church as a backdrop, a keeper of ethics, and a community. At present, when the creed is recited, I participate because I'm open to the beliefs and hold some of the beliefs myself. For me, the creed is a shared view, or perhaps goals, that may help people to permit themselves to be loving, open, or just live together. My journey has not had much boredom, at least not for me. I haven't been bored. I was born in Denver 36 years ago, baptized, I am told, at the age of 6 months into the Methodist Church, attended Sunday school, and at around the age of 5 or 6, I became interested in other churches, particularly the Catholic Church. I attended Mass and liked the ritual and many of the ideas, but I had trouble with the Latin and the notion of papal infallibility. So I tried, and I tried the rosary the way I thought that I should pray. And I remember my mother coming into the room, and I'd been kneeling on the floor for about an hour and a half and trying to say each Hail Mary and each Our Father very slowly and meaningfully. And she said, no, that's not the way you do it. And I couldn't understand it, so I gave it up and started attending St. Mary's Episcopal Church in Denver, which was very high church, quote-unquote, and very where the services were very close to the Catholic Church, except they were in English. I had a sense of religious vocation for myself, and I guess at that time that meant being a nun. Or if I went to the Episcopal Church, I could marry a priest, and it never occurred to me that I might directly aspire to ministry or being a priest myself. My family moved to Salt Lake in 1952. There was some religion there that I'd never encountered but was curious about. And my Episcopalian godfather paid my tuition to Roland Hall Girls' School, the Episcopal then girls' school, here for a semester, and I suspect, although it was never spelled out, that there was some nervousness on his part about proselyting zeal on the part of Mormons in the public schools. But that only lasted for a semester, and I began public school and began attending primary, because after all, who else do you play with on Tuesday afternoons? And I really enjoyed studying the Articles of Faith and learning about the Mormon Church, and I thought it was interesting, and I never received any pressure to renounce my church and join the LDS Church in the primary during the time I was attending primary. Neighbors, however, would give me tickets to the Friday night ward movies and then ask why I hadn't been in church on attended a meeting on Sunday. And I had a piano teacher who was very persistent, and as I started junior high, more and more time was taken with each lesson to inquire after my, quote, love life, unquote, which consisted of collecting stamps on Saturday afternoons with the bishop's son. He was an Episcopal bishop. And she kept asking when I was going to date a nice Mormon boy, so I changed piano teachers to one who was more interested in music. During this time, I attended St. Mark's Cathedral every Sunday morning, sang in the junior choir, read daily devotional literature, and religion for me seemed exciting, a struggle between good and evil, and it seemed to offer certainties on a dramatic scale that played a big part in my fantasy life. In high school, I came down with what I diagnose as Gentile paranoia, that feeling of being outside the community, although a certain ecumenical outlook accrued from the Gentile paranoia, that of regarding anyone, Baptist, Catholic, Jew, Buddhist, as a brother. As I became sexually active, my church attendance declined. I felt guilty in church, but loved by my boyfriend. After 2 years of college, I moved to California, leaving Salt Lake forever for the first time. I encountered anti-Catholic statements for the first time. I thought that was a historical phenomenon that had died out with the Know-Nothing Party in the 1890s. And I was astonished to hear the Catholics blamed as being disruptive and controlling the community when there's bigots. It was obvious that the only religion that ever dominated or controlled a community was Mormons. And it was a very nice mirror to see my own bigotry coming back at me. My boyfriend decided it was time for us to marry, and I couldn't imagine what I'd do without him, or else how to justify the intimacy we had had. And all my background in my church didn't equip me to be honest with myself about this step in my life and partaking in a sacrament in my church. We had priests do marriage counseling with us, but I was concerned to give right answers and feeling my answers would be unacceptable. And I remember a priest saying, well, if you're going to take the vow about in sickness and in health, my wife's had horrible back surgery and been ill for some time, and are you sure you're ready for back surgery? Well, at 20 years, you know, you're ready for anything. You what? But as superficial as the counseling was, I was not prepared for myself, to be honest, about my reasons for marrying. Shortly after my marriage, my parents separated, and a couple of months later, my mother died. I felt relief, guilt, and a sorrow so deep that it took years to surface. 4 months later, my husband was killed, and 3 friends and I were injured in a freak accident. Statements that, quote, a loving God knows best, fueled my anger, and I experienced church and church community as people who wanted every day to be Judgment Day, and who clucked over these events as slowly as I'd once tried to recite the rosary. I felt a Christian community was no help to me, nor vice versa, for the next few years. I returned to Salt Lake and lived with my father, completed my bachelor's in history at the U, and I marveled then at the limits of my avocational training. I brushed up my typing skills and resumed secretarial work. I was depressed. Overqualified, quote-unquote, and depressed. I returned to the university for a master's in education. After graduation, I left Salt Lake forever for the second time and moved to San Francisco. I couldn't find a job, traveled abroad, returned to San Francisco to pack up my U-Haul and move back to Salt Lake to marry. Our wedding was in an Episcopal chapel in the mountains, which we welcomed as a sacred setting to celebrate the joy and commitment we felt for each other. My husband's family is third and fourth generation Mormon, and they seemed relieved that their 27-year-old fallen away son was getting married and in any church. Marriage into a large Mormon family has given me ample opportunity to refute any generalizations made by other Gentile paranoiacs. I've been accepted into the family, but there are occasional pressures by one or two members to convert, and some statements about my lifestyle that suggest my religious beliefs may be of more concern to my in-laws than I am. And there is one in-law who does like to come over and check the dirt in the tray on the sliding glass door, you know, the patio door. I'm, okay, well. And he's never disappointed. I went back to work. Teaching was not rewarding, and I became a legal secretary. My husband had a job change, and we left Salt Lake forever for the third time to go to San Diego. I got my real estate license and had a very interesting, if not remunerative, experience with an honest, intelligent broker in Southern California real estate. Shortly after moving to San Diego, my car got in the way of a cement truck that had lost its brakes. A close friend was killed, but her child escaped uninjured. I was injured and back in a California hospital, having the feeling I'd done this before. I called my attorney for personal injury litigation, and when able, I went to church. I went to an Episcopal church in Del Mar, a very conservative parish, on the first Sunday that they were required to use the new prayer book. And the priest was using the new liturgy, and the congregation, immaculately clad and white-gloved, had their Moroccan leather-bound prayer books of the same tension in the arm that I use occasionally when I get impatient driving and make gestures. The tension in that congregation was really astonishing, and I did not go up to receive communion because I felt that whatever was being passed in that cup, I chose not to partake of. A year and a half later, a daughter was born to me and to my husband. And the miracle of her new life seemed to me to be such a reflection of the abundant and unwarranted love of God that I sought ways to express the spirituality and awe and celebration of the new responsibilities and the love that I felt for myself, for my husband, and my child. And she was baptized by a retired Episcopal bishop with her Mormon grandparents and her Catholic godparents in attendance. We then chose to move back to Salt Lake. We liked the climate, friends, family, mountains, and his parents felt that the community offered standards that perhaps could be rebelled against without great peril. We began attending St. James Episcopal Church and found it friendly and a place where we could bring the ambivalences, the troubled feelings, the gray areas for sorting and not for judging. As I had grown more at ease with myself, I could relax and be open to what an institution might offer. Richard and Ann Thiem became co-rectors at St. James. We found ourselves going to church every Sunday because it made us happy. Sunday afternoon became a comfortable time, and we didn't should on each other. A great bugaboo of our weekends. We should do this, you should do that. And it relieved that burden for us. The Reverend Ann Thiem has been very special to me, an object of envy, a role model, and a loving woman and friend. She's been able to combine intellectual discussion of theology with openness about deep feelings. It's extraordinary and difficult to describe how I feel when she celebrates communion. The voice of a woman, my voice, knowing what childbirth or being a wife is and isn't, as principal celebrant in a service, is a very extraordinary feeling for me. Within the last 18 months, I joined a small discussion group, which has been wonderfully helpful to me in coping with my quandaries in a way that's both spiritual and specific. And I have come to feel that today is God's gift to me. It's mine, and I choose to rejoice. I choose to react to the spark of God that may be within me, to act upon the yes, although I don't know where the yes leads. I do know completely where the no leads, into ever-narrowing circles of despair. And I've carried and clothed myself in this girdle of despair. But my heart wants more. I want to know joy and serenity and acceptance. And I believe that these are circles that are ever widening like the circles of a pond.
I should have told you before that I hope you're writing down questions or comments that you want to make, because you're going to have about a half an hour after the conclusion of our last speaker to express your feelings or to ask questions of our panelists. Our concluding speaker is Bernice Mooney. She's a member of the Catholic faith. She received her BA in English and Spanish from the University of Utah, her MA from the University of California at Dominguez Hills in 1980 in humanities. She is the mother of five children, the past president of the Altar Society of the Salt Lake City Catholic Diocese, and she recently has completed a history of the Cathedral of the Madeleine. Bernice Mooney.
The history of the Catholic Church in Utah tells of some inspiring men. Among them, the pioneer priest Lawrence Scanlon, who constructed the Cathedral of the Madeleine. But less has been written about the women who helped build up the Catholic Church in Utah, and I welcome this opportunity to tell you about one of them, whose name was Amanda Anderson. She had been born in 1830 in Alexandria, Virginia. Because of her mother's early death when she was only 4 years old, she was reared by an aunt, Mrs. Lilly, who lived on a ranch just outside of Lancaster, Ohio. Amanda had found the ranch an amazing place, full of adventure. There was a grist mill where Mr. Lilly ground the flour for all the countryside, and Indians brought their corn to be turned to meal. There being no Catholic church within a radius of 50 miles, Mrs. Lilly fitted up a chapel where the priest came to celebrate Mass for the people of the area, and she built a shelter to house farmers and Indians coming from a distance. Amanda helped the Indians and the genial missionary priest who considered her his sacristan. For her academic education, she rode horseback to a small school, but without formal training, She was receiving a rich and varied experience in social service. By the time she was 14, she herself rode out regularly to the Indian reservations and to visit the poor and sick whom the mission priest reported to her aunt, taking food and medicine to them. Sometimes she spent the night caring for them. In 1854, when she was 24 years old, she asked admission to the pioneer community of the Holy Cross Sisters at St. Mary's in Notre Dame, Indiana. She was clothed in the habit of the nuns and assumed the name of Sister Augusta. In 1861, during the Civil War, she was summoned to Cairo, Illinois, the dividing line between North and South, to care for General Grant's soldiers. She and her two companions found the military hospital wards where hundreds of boys from both North and South died in frightful condition. She wrote later, "Many wounded men whose limbs had been amputated were there with little or no care. We washed the blood-stained walls and scrubbed the floors. Dr. Burke sent in some men to carry away the legs, arms, and pieces of human bodies that were lying around. Later, I was sent to Memphis to take charge of the Overton Hospital. We had neither beds, nor towels, nor soap. The patients brought in were literally crawling with vermin. The blockage prevented our getting the necessary supplies." General Grant often consulted her about the care of his soldiers, and she came to be called a soldier's friend. He said once of her, "She can control the men better than I can." By 1870, she was back at her mother house at St. Mary's, where she began a quarter century of continuous service to her order, first as superior, and then in 1889, as the first Mother General of the Sisters of the Holy Cross in the United States. But a colorful missionary interlude came in April 1875 when Father Lawrence Scanlon wrote asking her to open a school in Salt Lake. She decided to ride one of the huge canvas-covered carts out across the prairies and plains to see Salt Lake for herself. Father Kiley, Bishop Scanlon's lifelong friend and assistant, traveled to Green River to meet Sister Augusta and her companion, Sister Raymond. In Salt Lake, their arrival was awaited by the young Father Scanlon, who had only been there 2 years himself, and who lived with only the bare necessities of life at that time in humble rooms behind the little brick church built by his predecessor, Father Walsh, in 1871. The only Catholic church in a region of 85,000 square miles. Territorial Judge Thomas Marshall and his wife, who was a Catholic, welcomed the nuns into their home. The family's big St. Bernard dog adopted the sisters and went everywhere with them. Judge Marshall arranged a meeting with Brigham Young, who received the sisters kindly and encouraged them to stay. He explained that he could not help them financially, but he certainly encouraged them to open the school. Within 2 days, Sister Augusta had decided to stay in Salt Lake, and within a week, plans were drawn, with the help of architect Davis, who was stationed at Fort Douglas, for a new building to cost $25,000. Well, the work of soliciting the funds fell upon Sister Augusta and Sister Raymond. Week after week, from Monday through Saturday, they went on the road begging. They visited every mining camp in the territory, from Park City to Frisco, climbing to the highest peaks of Alta for the famous Reed and Benson mine, and the Prince of Wales were then employing many men. After 3 months' arduous labor, the building was ready, and its doors opened in September 1875. Even though there were only about 9 Catholic families in Salt Lake, 100 pupils, mostly Protestant, had enrolled at the end of the first week, 5 of them as boarding students. The success of the school was immediate, and other sisters were brought to the work. The favorable impression made by the sisters in the various mining camps and smelters led to a petition of miners asking them to open a hospital in Salt Lake. For $50 a month, Sister Augusta rented a brick house on Fifth East, which would accommodate 12 patients, and thus she founded the Holy Cross Hospital. There followed, in the next years, an expansion of these institutions, as well as similar foundations such as St. Anne's Orphanage or the early beginnings of Judge Memorial High School. Sister Augusta's courage and vision had helped prepare the way for similar foundations in California and other states. When she returned to her mother house as Mother General, a new challenge awaited her: the slow and difficult transfer of authority from the founding fathers of Holy Cross to the sisters themselves. Largely through Mother Augusta's efforts, the sisters achieved autonomy for the first time in all matters, spiritual and temporal. During her tenure, the first buildings, which now comprise St. Mary's, across from Notre Dame in Indiana, were erected. 25 missions were opened, including the first mission to India, and 6 hospitals were established. Mother Augusta's life becomes an inspiration to those of us today who are entering more and more into the new frontiers of women in religion. Thank you.